fluent and voluble as you please, wit at will, and never at a loss for a story to tell while he is shaving and combing me. He contributes more than I could have imagined to my comfort in this life. But having received her letter, Adams became about as tender as he would allow on paper. Is there no way for two friendly souls to converse together, although the bodies are 400 miles off? Yes, by letter. But I want a better communication. I want to hear you think, or to see your thoughts. The conclusion of your letter makes my heart throb more than a cannonade would. You bid me burn your letters. But I must forget you first. She followed at length, this time with thoughts on his concerns, writing that a people may let a king fall, yet still remain a people. But if a king let his people slip from him, he is no longer a king. And as this is most certainly our case, why not proclaim to the world in decisive terms our own importance? "I think you shine as a stateswoman," he responded exuberantly. And in another letter wrote, "Your sentiments of the duties we owe to our country are such as become the best of women and the best of men. Among all the disappointments and perplexities which have fallen my share in life, nothing has contributed so much to support my mind as the choice blessing of a wife. I want to take a walk with you in the garden, to go over to the common, the plain, the meadow. I want to take Charles in one hand and Tom in the other and walk with you, Nabby on your right hand and John on my left, to view the cornfields, the orchards. Alas, poor imagination! How faintly and imperfectly do you supply the want of the original and reality!" Spring had arrived. Days of warm April rain and intermittent sunshine followed one another. Trees were leafing out. In the enclosed backyards of the city, cherry blossoms burst into flower, followed by a profusion of lilacs in bloom. Behind the closed doors of Congress, the current of events seemed also to turn with the season as the delegates of three southern colonies, South Carolina, Georgia, and North Carolina, received instructions freeing them to vote for independence. Even among the opposition, there was growing agreement on the need for unanimity, harmony, a healing of disputes. "It is a true saying of a wit," wrote Carter Braxton of Virginia, referring possibly to Benjamin Franklin, "we must hang together or separately." Then, on the afternoon of Wednesday, May 8th, Philadelphia heard the muffled but unmistakable thunder of cannon from 30 miles down the Delaware, as two heavily armed British ships, the frigate Roebuck and sloop of war Liverpool, tried to run the river defenses, a blockade of armed gondolas. The crash of cannon went on for 2 days before the ships turned back. No great damage was done, and to many it all seemed, as said in the Pennsylvania Gazette, a most interesting spectacle. Thousands rushed by carriage and horseback to watch from the shoreline. But it had also been vivid proof that the war was no abstraction, and could, in fact, come to Philadelphia in all its fury, a thought many had preferred not to face. The British fleet that evacuated Boston, it was now known, had sailed to Halifax, where presumably it was waiting for reinforcements before returning to attack New York. By sundown, May 9th, the excitement down the river had ended. On the day after, Friday, May 10th, came what many in Congress knew to be a critical juncture. Adams had decided the time was ripe to make his move. With Richard Henry Lee, he put forth a resolution recommending that the individual colonies assume all powers of government, to secure the happiness and safety of their constituents in particular and America in general. Not only was it passed, but with surprising unanimity. It awaited only a preamble, which, as drafted by Adams, was a still more radical statement. This brought on 3 days of fierce debate, during which Adams repeatedly took the floor, supported by Richard Henry Lee, while James Wilson of Pennsylvania argued in opposition. A decision that could clear the way to independence had at last arrived. In contrast to the resolution, Adams's preamble put aside any possibility of reconciliation and all but declared the colonies immediately independent. Whereas His Britannic Majesty, in conjunction with the Lords and Commons of Great Britain, has, by a late act of Parliament, excluded the inhabitants of these United Colonies from the protection of His Crown, and whereas no answer whatever to the humble petitions of the colonies for redress of grievances and reconciliation with Great Britain has been or is likely to be given. But the whole force of that kingdom, aided by foreign mercenaries, is to be exerted for the destruction of the good people of these colonies. And whereas it appears absolutely irreconcilable to reason and good conscience for people of these colonies to take the oaths and affirmations necessary for the support of any government under the Crown of Great Britain, it is therefore necessary that the exercise of every kind of authority under the said crown should be totally suppressed, and all the powers of government exerted under the authority of the people of the colonies, for the preservation of internal peace, virtue, and good order, as well as the defense of their lives, liberties, and properties against hostile invasions and cruel depredations of their enemies. "Why all this haste?" James Duane demanded, according to notes that Adams kept. "Why all this driving?" Samuel Adams, who rarely spoke in Congress, rose from his place. "I wonder the people have conducted so well as they have," he said. James Wilson responded, "Before we are prepared to build a new house, why should we pull down the old one and expose ourselves to all the inclemencies of the season?" John Dickinson was absent, apparently indisposed, a victim of exhaustion. What John Adams said was not recorded. But as the constant battler on the floor, with all that he had written, his work on committees, his relentless energy, industry, and unyielding determination, he had emerged a leader like no other. And when the breakthrough came at last on Wednesday, May 15th, it was his victory more than anyone's in Congress. The preamble was approved. When an exasperated James Duane told Adams it seemed a machine for the fabrication of independence, Adams replied that he thought it independence itself. He was elated. Congress, he wrote, had that day passed the most important resolution that was ever taken in America. Others agreed. Even the cool, considerate men think it amounts to a declaration of independence, wrote Caesar Rodney enthusiastically. Most telling was the immediate effect in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia itself, where popular opinion took a dramatic turn in support of independence. At his lodgings 2 days later, Adams sat quietly writing to Abigail. "When I consider the great events which are past, and those greater which are rapidly advancing, and that I may have been instrumental of touching some springs and turning some wheels which have had and will have such effects, I feel an awe upon my mind which is not easily described. I have reasons to believe," he added, "that no colony which shall assume a government under the people will give it up." Section 3. The days had become as warm as summer. "Fine sunshine," recorded Adams's Philadelphia friend Christopher Marshall one day after another. "Uncommonly hot, uncomfortable both to horse and man," registered Josiah Bartlett, who, returning to Congress from the cool of New Hampshire, was astonished to see fields of winter rye in New Jersey already full-grown by the middle of May. Thomas Jefferson, on reaching Philadelphia, decided, as the excessive heats of the city are coming fast, to find lodgings on the skirts of town where I may have the benefit of circulating air. He moved to spacious quarters in a new brick house at the southwest corner of 7th and Market, in what was nearly open country. They were larger, more expensive accommodations than most delegates had, a suite of two rooms, bedroom and parlor on the second floor, with ample windows for circulating air, and, unlike most delegates, he would reside alone, separate from the rest. Jefferson had arrived on May 14th, after a pleasant week's journey by horseback from the Piedmont of Virginia, accompanied by a single servant, a 14-year-old slave named Bob Hemmings. Jefferson's road to Philadelphia, the reverse of Adams's, had been north by northeast, through the red clay countryside of Virginia to Nolan's Ferry on the Potomac, then on into Maryland, winding past miles of prosperous-looking farms that became still more prosperous-looking as he crossed into Pennsylvania. On resuming his seat in Congress, at the climax of debate over Adams's preamble, Jefferson had felt as nearly unsuited for the business at hand as for the stifling city climate. "I've been so long out of the political world that I am almost a new man in it," he wrote his college friend and confidant John Page. He worried about his ill wife at home. Given the choice, he would have preferred to be at Williamsburg, where a new Virginia Constitution was being drafted. Of more immediate concern than the doings of Congress, it would appear from what he wrote Page, were some books, a two-volume French history of the Celts, and a book on English gardens that he hoped Page would purchase for him from an estate sale. At 33, Thomas Jefferson was the youngest of the Virginia delegates. He had not attended the first Congress, when Washington and Patrick Henry had been part of the delegation, and the Virginians, with their liveried servants and splendid horses, had ridden into the city like princelings. His role in the second Congress had been on the whole modest. If he was conspicuous, it was mainly because of his height. At 6 feet 2.5 inches, he stood taller than all but a few and towered over someone like John Hancock, who at 5 feet 4 was perhaps the shortest man in the assembly. Standing beside John Adams, Jefferson looked like a lanky, freckled youth. With 8 years' difference in their ages, Adams was Jefferson's senior both in years and political experience. The differences in physique, background, manner, and temperament could hardly have been more contrasting. Where Adams was stout, Jefferson was lean and long-limbed, almost bony. Where Adams stood four square to the world, shoulders back, Jefferson customarily stood with his arms folded tightly across his chest. When taking his seat, it was as if he folded into a chair, all knees and elbows and abnormally large hands and feet. Where Adams was nearly bald, Jefferson had a full head of thick, coppery hair. His freckled face was lean like his body, the eyes hazel, the mouth a thin line, the chin sharp. Jefferson was a superb horseman, beautiful to see. He sang. He played the violin. He was as accomplished in the classics as Adams, but also in mathematics, horticulture, architecture. And in his interest in and knowledge of science, he far exceeded Adams. Jefferson dabbled in improvements in agriculture and mechanical devices. His was the more inventive mind. He adored designing and redesigning things of all kinds. Jefferson, who may never have actually put his own hand to a plow, as Adams had, would devise an improved plow based on mathematical principles, a mold board of least resistance, and find equal satisfaction in arriving at the perfect shape for a stone column or silver goblet. Jefferson was devoted to the ideal of improving mankind, but had comparatively little interest in people in particular. Adams was not inclined to believe mankind improvable, but was certain it was important that human nature be understood. In contrast to Adams's need to fill pages of his diaries with his innermost thoughts and feelings, Jefferson kept neat account books. In an invariably precise hand, he recorded every purchase, every payment for meals, wines, books, violin strings, the least item of clothing. Unlike Adams, who, except for books, indulged himself in no expenditures beyond what were necessary, Jefferson was continually in and out of Philadelphia shops, buying whatever struck his fancy. In the spirit of science, Jefferson maintained letter-perfect records of weights, measurements, and daily temperature readings. Adams is not known even to have owned a thermometer. "Nothing was too small for him to keep account of," one of his plantation overseers would remember of Jefferson. Yet he kept no personal diary, and for all the hours given to what he called pen and ink work, Jefferson rarely ever revealed his inner feelings in what he wrote. He had nothing like Adams's fascination with human nature, and, quite unlike Adams, little sense of humor. "He is a man of science," a close observer would later write of Jefferson, "but he knows little of the nature of man, very little indeed." It was Jefferson's graciousness that was so appealing. He was never blunt or assertive, as Adams could be, but subtle, serene by all appearances, always polite, soft-spoken, and diplomatic, if somewhat remote. With Adams, there was seldom a doubt about what he meant by what he said. With Jefferson, there was nearly always a slight air of ambiguity. In private conversation, Jefferson sparkled. But in Congress, like Franklin, he scarcely said a word, and if he did, it was in a voice so weak as to be almost inaudible. Rarely would he object to a point or disagree with anyone to his face. "Never contradict anybody," he was advised by Franklin, whom he admired above all men, though it was advice he hardly needed. He abhorred dispute, as he said, shrank from the contentiousness of politics, and instinctively avoided confrontation of any kind. It was as if he were trying to proceed through life as he had designed his moldboard plow to go through the red clay of Virginia, with the least resistance possible. Years later, still puzzling over Jefferson's passivity at Philadelphia, Adams would claim that, "During the whole time I sat with him in Congress, I never heard him utter three sentences together." Jefferson himself would one day advise a grandson, "When I hear another express an opinion which is not mine, I say to myself, he has a right to his opinion as I to mine. Why should I question it? His error does me no injury, and shall I become a Don Quixote to bring all men by force of argument to one opinion? Be a listener only. Keep within yourself, and endeavor to establish with yourself the habit of silence, especially in politics." Jefferson wished to avoid the rough and tumble of life whenever possible. John Adams's irrepressible desire was to seize hold of it, and at times his was to be the path of Don Quixote. A departure from Jefferson's prevailing silence in Congress came late that summer when he stood in opposition to a proposal for a fast day, and in so doing appeared to cast aspersions on Christianity, to which Adams reacted sharply. Benjamin Rush reminded Adams of the incident in a letter written years later. "You rose and defended the motion, and in reply to Mr. Jefferson's objections to Christianity, you said you were sorry to hear such sentiments from a gentleman whom you so highly respected and with whom you agreed upon so many subjects, and that it was the only instance you had ever known of a man of sound sense and real genius that was an enemy to Christianity. You suspected, you told me, that you had offended him, but that he soon convinced you to the contrary by crossing the room and taking a seat in the chair next to you." In one regard only did Jefferson's behavior seem at odds with his usual placid way. If unwilling or unable to express anger or passion in his dealings with other men, he could be very different with his horse. As would be said within his own family, "The only impatience of temper he ever exhibited was with his horse, which he subdued to his will by a fearless application of the whip on the slightest manifestation of restiveness." As the author of the Summary View, the young Virginian had, as Adams said, achieved the reputation of a masterly pen, and however reticent in Congress, he proved prompt, frank, explicit, and decisive upon committees and in conversation. That Jefferson, after attending the College of William and Mary, had read law at Williamsburg for 5 years with the eminent George Wythe, gave him still greater standing with Adams, who considered Wythe one of the ablest men in Congress. In his journal, Adams recorded a remark made by the New Yorker James Duane to the effect that Jefferson was the greatest rubber-off of dust that Duane had ever met, and that he spoke French, Italian, and Spanish, and was working on German. The journal entry, dated October 25, 1775, was Adams's first recorded mention of Jefferson. Sensitive to Adams's seniority and his importance in Congress, and possibly to Adams's vanity, Jefferson was consistently deferential to him. Clearly, too, for all their differences, they had much in common, not the least of which was their love of words, of books, and serious scholarship. They were as widely read, as learned, as any two men in Congress. A list of the favorite authors of either could have served for the other. They had read the same law, distinguished themselves at an early age in the same profession, though Jefferson had never relished the practice of law as Adams had, nor felt the financial need to keep at it. They were men who loved noble endeavor, who shared a disdain for indolence, and hated wasting time. Jefferson's devotion to home, to family, and his own native ground was quite as strong as Adams's. When Jefferson spoke of my country, he usually meant Virginia, as Adams referred to Massachusetts as my country. The one was as proudly a Virginian as the other a Yankee. The stamp of their origins was strong on both, and neither would have acknowledged any better place on earth than his country, though neither, it is true, had yet seen much else. As Adams had never been farther south than Philadelphia, Jefferson had been no farther north than New York. But in this, too, was the root of differences that ran deep and would prove long-lasting, for the reason that Massachusetts and Virginia were truly different countries. Indeed, it would be difficult for future generations to comprehend how much separated a man raised on a freeholder's farm in coastal New England from a son of Virginia such as Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson had been born to respectable wealth achieved by his father, Peter Jefferson, a man of rugged vitality, tobacco planter and surveyor, and to an unassailable place in the Virginia aristocracy through his mother, Jane, who was a Randolph. His landholdings in Albemarle County, mostly inherited from his father, exceeded 5,000 acres. But where Adams, at his farm by Penn's Hill, lived very much like his father and among the people of the town, Jefferson, very unlike his father or other Virginia planters, had removed to a mountaintop, removed from contact with everyday life, to create a palatial country seat of his own design in the manner of the 16th-century Italian architect Andrea Palladio. It was a bold undertaking that spoke of unusually cultivated taste and high ambition, and was made possible by the added wealth that came with his marriage to Martha Wales Skelton, a young widow. He had started the project at the age of 25, in 1768. Still only partly built, it had the high, columned porticos of a classic Italian villa and carried a name, Monticello, meaning Little Mountain in Old Italian. He had contracted for 100,000 bricks, ordered specially made window frames from London, and in Philadelphia purchased the unexpired servitude of an indentured servant, a stonecutter, to do the columns. It was a house and setting such as John Adams had never seen or could ever have imagined as his own, any more than he could have imagined the scale of Jefferson's domain. On his daily rounds by horseback, surveying his crops and fields, where as many as 100 black slaves labored, Jefferson would commonly ride 10 miles, as far as from Braintree to Boston, without ever leaving his own land. Further, he owned another 5,000-acre plantation to the southwest in Bedford County, an inheritance from his wife's father. Jefferson had been raised and educated as the perfect landed gentleman of Virginia. He knew no other way. His earliest childhood memory was of being carried on a pillow by a slave, and in countless ways he had been carried ever since by slaves, though they were never called that, but rather servants or laborers. It was not just that slaves worked his fields. They cut his firewood, cooked and served his meals, washed and ironed his linen, brushed his suits, nursed his children, cleaned, scrubbed, polished, opened and closed doors for him, saddled his horse, turned down his bed, waited on him hand and foot from dawn to dusk. By 1776, with the addition of the land inherited from his father-in-law, Jefferson reckoned himself a wealthy man, and lived like one. With the inheritance also came substantial debts and still more slaves, but then in Virginia this was seen as a matter of course. The whole economy and way of life were built on slaves and debt, with tobacco planters in particular dependent on slave labor and money borrowed from English creditors against future crops. John Adams, by contrast, had neither debts nor slaves, and all his life abhorred the idea of either. In keeping with his background, Adams was less than dazzled by the Virginia grandees. In Virginia, he would say, all geese are swans. Jefferson, for his part, knew little or nothing of New Englanders, and counted none as friends. A man of cultivated, even fastidious tastes, Jefferson was later to tell his Virginia neighbor, James Madison, that he had observed in Adams a certain want of taste, this apparently in reference to the fact that Adams was known on occasion to chew tobacco and take his rum more or less straight. Jefferson had been slower, more cautious, and ambivalent than Adams about resolving his views on independence. As recently as August 1775, less than a year past, Jefferson had written to a Tory kinsman, John Randolph, of looking with fondness towards a reconciliation with Great Britain. He longed for the return of the happy period when, consistently with duty, I may withdraw myself totally from the public stage and pass the rest of my days in domestic ease and tranquillity, banishing every desire of afterwards even hearing what passes in the world. But in the same letter he declared that, rather than submit to the right of legislating for us assumed by the British Parliament, and which late experience has shown they will so cruelly exercise, I would lend my hand to sink the whole island in the ocean. His commitment, now in the spring of 1776, was no less than Adams's own. And it was because of their common zeal for independence, their wholehearted mutual devotion to the common cause of America, and the certainty that they were taking part in one of history's turning points, that the two were able to concentrate on the common purpose in a spirit of respect and cooperation, putting aside obvious differences, as well as others not so obvious and more serious than they could then have known. Adams considered Jefferson his protégé at Philadelphia. Jefferson, impressed by Adams's clarity and vigor in argument, his sound head, looked upon him as a mentor. They served on committees together, and as the pace quickened in the weeks after Jefferson's arrival, they were together much of the time. As would be said, each felt the value of the other in the common task. If there was a tide in the affairs of men, as Abigail had reminded John, now was the flood. Every post and every day rolls in upon us independence like a torrent, he wrote on May 20th. Despite drenching rain, an open-air public meeting that day at the State House Yard drew a throng of thousands who listened as the May 15th resolve was read aloud, then voiced a demand vote for a new Pennsylvania Constitution and a new legislature. At week's end, on Friday, May 24th, General Washington arrived for 2 days of meetings with Congress to report his heightened concern for the situation at New York, where a British attack was expected any time. The King, it was now known, had hired some 17,000 German troops to fight in America. At New York, Washington had at most 7,000 men fit for duty. 3 days later came word that on May 15th, the Virginia Convention at Williamsburg had resolved unanimously to instruct the Virginia delegation at Philadelphia to declare the United Colonies free and independent states. An exultant John Adams wrote to Patrick Henry that the natural course and order of things was coming to pass at last. The decree has gone forth, and it cannot be recalled, that a more equal liberty than had prevailed in other parts of the earth must be established in America. On Friday, June 7th, at the State House, Richard Henry Lee rose to speak. Sunshine streamed through the high windows. Lee, slim and elegant, was a spirited orator who was said to practice his gestures before a mirror. In a hunting accident years before, he had lost the fingers of his left hand, which he kept wrapped in a black handkerchief, and this, with his lithe figure and aquiline nose, gave him a decidedly theatrical presence. The importance of the moment was understood by everyone in the room. "Resolved," Lee began, "that these United Colonies are, and of a right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved." Adams immediately seconded the motion, and the day following, Saturday, June 8th, the debate began. Speaking in opposition, John Dickinson, James Wilson, Robert Livingston, and Edward Rutledge declared, according to notes kept by Jefferson, that while friends of the measure, they opposed any declaration of independence until the voice of the people drove them to it. Further, should Congress proceed before hearing the voice, then certain colonies might secede from the Union. It was the threat Dickinson, in his anger, had used earlier against Adams. But whether it was Dickinson speaking now, Jefferson did not record. Nor did he record what Adams, Lee, and George Wythe said. Only that they declared public opinion to be ahead of Congress. That the people wait for us to lead the way. That the European powers would neither trade nor treat with the colonies until they established independence. That the present military campaign may be unsuccessful, and therefore we had better propose an alliance while our affairs wear a hopeful aspect. And that it was essential to lose no time. Intense debate continued past dark. Candles were brought in. The sensible part of the House opposed the motion, wrote an irate Edward Rutledge. No reason could be assigned for pressing into this measure, but the reason of every madman. On Monday, June 10th, after President John Hancock reconvened the Assembly, Rutledge and the Cool Party succeeded in having the final vote delayed for 20 days until July 1st, to allow delegates from the middle colonies time to send for new instructions. Nonetheless, it was agreed that no time be lost in preparing a declaration of independence. A committee was appointed, the Committee of Five, as it became known, consisting of Jefferson, Adams, Roger Sherman, Robert Livingston, and Benjamin Franklin, who had by now returned from his expedition to Canada, but was ill and exhausted and rarely seen. On the floor above, meantime, in the banqueting hall of the State House, another revolution was transpiring as the Pennsylvania Assembly struggled over what instructions to give its delegation. Adams, who had not written a word to Abigail in nearly 2 weeks, dashed off a letter, saying, "Great things are on the tappy." Jefferson was to draft the declaration. But how this was agreed to was never made altogether clear. He and Adams would have differing explanations, each writing long after the fact. According to Adams, Jefferson proposed that he, Adams, do the writing, but that he declined, telling Jefferson he must do it. "Why?" Jefferson asked, as Adams would recount. "Reasons enough," Adams said. "What can be your reasons?" "Reason first, you are a Virginian, and a Virginian ought to appear at the head of this business. Reason second, I am obnoxious, suspected, and unpopular. You are very much otherwise. Reason third, you can write 10 times better than I can." Jefferson would recall no such exchange. As Jefferson remembered, the committee simply met and unanimously chose him to undertake the draft. "I consented. I drew it up." Possibly neither of their memories served, and possibly both were correct. Jefferson may well have been the choice of the committee, and out of deference or natural courtesy, he may well have offered Adams the honor. If there is anything that seems not in keeping, it is the tone of Adams's self-deprecation, which is more that of the old man he became than the Adams of 1776, who was anything but inadequate as a writer, and who was by no means as unpopular as he later said. If he was thought obnoxious, it would have been only by a few. And only he himself is known to have used the word. In all the surviving record of official and private papers pertaining to the Continental Congress, there is only one member or eyewitness to events in Philadelphia in 1776 who wrote disparagingly of John Adams, and that was Adams, writing long years afterward. As critical as he could be in his assessment of others, The man he was inclined to criticize most severely was himself. In fact, the respect he commanded at Philadelphia that spring appears to have been second to none. Unquestionably, Adams did value Jefferson's literary talents. But he also knew how much else he must attend to in the little time available. And the outcome of the great question was by no means certain. Already, Adams was serving on 23 committees, and that same week was assigned to three more, including an all-important new Continental Board of War and Ordnance, of which he was to be the president. That there would be political advantage in having the Declaration written by a Virginian was clear, for the same reason there had been political advantage in having the Virginian Washington in command of the army. But be that as it may, Jefferson, with his peculiar felicity of expression, as Adams said, was the best choice for the task, just as Washington had been the best choice to command the Continental Army, and again, Adams had played a key part. Had his contribution as a member of Congress been only that of casting the two Virginians in their respective fateful roles, his service to the American cause would have been very great. Alone in his upstairs parlor at 7th and Market, Jefferson went to work. Seated in an unusual revolving Windsor chair and holding on his lap a portable writing box, a small folding desk of his own design, which, like the chair, he had had specially made for him by a Philadelphia cabinet maker. Traffic rattled by below the open windows. The June days and nights turned increasingly warm. He worked rapidly, and, to judge by surviving drafts, with a sure command of his material. He had none of his books with him, nor needed any, he later claimed. It was not his objective to be original, he would explain, only to place before mankind the common sense of the subject. Neither aiming at originality of principle or sentiment, nor yet copied from any particular and previous writing, it was intended to be an expression of the American mind, and to give to that expression the proper tone and spirit called for by the occasion. He borrowed readily from his own previous writing, particularly from a recent draft for a new Virginia Constitution, but also from a Declaration of Rights for Virginia, which had appeared in the Pennsylvania Evening Post on June 12th. It had been drawn up by George Mason, who wrote that all men are born equally free and independent, and have certain inherent natural rights, among which are the enjoyment of life and liberty. And there was a pamphlet written by the Pennsylvania delegate James Wilson, published in Philadelphia in 1774, that declared, "All men are, by nature, equal and free. No one has a right to any authority over another without his consent. All lawful government is founded on the consent of those who are subject to it." But then Mason, Wilson, and John Adams, no less than Jefferson, were, as they all appreciated, drawing on long familiarity with the seminal works of the English and Scottish writers John Locke, David Hume, Francis Hutcheson, and Henry St. John Bolingbroke, or such English poets as Defoe. "When kings the sword of justice first lay down, they are no kings, though they possess the crown. Titles are shadows, crowns are empty things. The good of subjects is the end of kings." Or, for that matter, Cicero, "The people's good is the highest law." Adams, in his earlier notes for an oration at Braintree, had written, "Nature throws us all into the world equal and alike. The only maxim of a free government ought to be to trust no man, kings included, to endanger public liberty." The purpose of government, he had said in his recent Thoughts on Government, was the greatest quantity of human happiness. What made Jefferson's work surpassing was the grace and eloquence of expression. Jefferson had done superbly and in minimum time. I was delighted with its high tone and flights of oratory with which it abounded, Adams would recall, especially that concerning Negro slavery, which, though I knew his Southern brethren would never suffer to pass in Congress, I certainly would never oppose. There were other expressions which I would not have inserted, if I had drawn it up, particularly that which called the king tyrant. I thought the expression too passionate, and too much like scolding for so grave and solemn a document. But as Franklin and Sherman were to inspect it afterwards, I thought it would not become me to strike it out. I consented to report it, and do not now remember that I made or suggested a single alteration. A number of alterations were made, however, when Jefferson reviewed it with the committee, and several were by Adams. Possibly it was Franklin or Jefferson himself who made the small but inspired change in the second paragraph. Where in the original draft certain truths were described as sacred and undeniable, a simpler, stronger, self-evident was substituted. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Adams had no doubt that there would be further changes called for and considerable debate over details and language once the Declaration was submitted to Congress for approval. Still, he was confident enough about the draft that he laboriously transcribed the full text in his own hand and later sent the copy to Abigail, who, understandably, thought he had written the Declaration. The pressures of responsibility grew greater for Adams almost by the hour. As head of the new Board of War, meeting every morning and evening, he was acutely aware of Washington's distress at New York. Dispatch riders from the general's headquarters brought repeated warnings that arms, lead, flints, medicines, and entrenching tools were all urgently needed. At Boston, the troops were almost mutinous in want of pay. In Canada, where the remnants of an American army were still holding out, the situation was gravely compounded by the ravages of smallpox. On June 15th, the provincial legislature of New Jersey had ordered the arrest of its royal governor, William Franklin, the estranged, illegitimate son of Benjamin Franklin, and authorized its delegates in Congress to vote for independence. To see that this was done, 5 new New Jersey delegates had been appointed. In Maryland, Delegate Samuel Chase, who had earlier gone to Canada with Benjamin Franklin, was rounding up support for independence, as perhaps no one else could have. A huge, red-faced young man of inexhaustible energy, Chase refused to accept the dictum that Maryland's delegates must vote down independence. "I have not been idle," he reported to Adams. As he had for months now, Adams struggled to keep a balance with the need on one hand for all possible haste, and the need on the other to keep from pushing too fast, forcing events too soon. Some things, some people, must not be hurried. Time and timing were both of the essence, now more than ever. Reminders of time passing were everywhere about him. The great clock ticking away on the outside wall of the State House. Bells at night striking the hour. The clarions of 100 roosters calling across town as he began his day at first light. "What in the name of common sense are you gentlemen of the Continental Congress about?" demanded a constituent writing from Massachusetts. "Is it dozing? The only question is concerning the proper time for making a specific declaration in words," Adams replied. "Some people must have time to look around them, before, behind, on the right hand, and on the left, and then to think, and after all this, to resolve. Others see at one intuitive glance into the past and the future and judge with precision at once. But remember, you can't make 13 clocks strike precisely alike at the same second. No one in Congress had worked harder or done more to bring about a break with Britain. But it was the fact of independence more than the words on paper that concerned Adams, and especially for what it would do to unify the colonies and bring spirit to American military operations. Facts were stubborn things, he had once argued in defense of the British soldiers after the Boston Massacre, and as stubborn as any of the large facts bearing heavily on his mind now, was the bloody conflict we are destined to endure. On June 23rd, a conference of committees from every county in Pennsylvania declared that the delegates of Pennsylvania in Congress should vote for independence. "You see, therefore," Adams wrote to Samuel Chase, "that there is such a universal expectation that the great question will be decided the 1st of July, to postpone it again would hazard convulsions and dangerous conspiracies." The birth of a new nation was at hand. Perhaps, truly, as Thomas Paine had written, a new world. "Solemn," was Adams's word for the atmosphere in Congress. Chapter 3. Colossus of Independence. His power of thought and expression moved us from our seats. Thomas Jefferson. Section 1. Monday, July 1st, 1776, began hot and steamy in Philadelphia, and before the morning was ended, a full-scale summer storm would break. Adams, as usual, was out of bed before dawn. He dressed, wrote a long letter to a former delegate, Archibald Bullock, who was the new president of Georgia, and following breakfast, walked to the State House, knowing what was in store. "This morning is assigned the greatest debate of all," he had said in the letter. "A declaration that these colonies are free and independent states has been reported by a committee some weeks ago for that purpose, and this day or tomorrow is to determine its fate. May heaven prosper the newborn republic." He had wished Bullock to know also that constant vigil was being kept for the arrival of the British at New York. "We are in daily expectation of an armament before New York, where, if it comes, the conflict may be bloody," he warned. Words in debate were one thing, the war quite another. But to Adams, independence and the war were never disjunctive. "The object is great which we have in view, and we must expect a great expense of blood to obtain it. But we should always remember that a free constitution of civil government cannot be purchased at too dear a rate, as there is nothing on this side of Jerusalem of equal importance to mankind." Presumably, everything that could or need be said on the question of independence had been exhausted in Congress. Presumably, the question could be put and decided with little further ado. But it was not to be. John Dickinson had resolved to make one last appeal, and Adams would be obliged to answer. They would rise to make their cases like the great lawyers they were, each summoning all his powers of reason and persuasion. At 10 o'clock, with the doors closed, John Hancock sounded the gavel. Richard Henry Lee's prior motion calling for independence was again read aloud. The Congress resolved itself into a committee of the whole and resumed consideration. Immediately, Dickinson, gaunt and deathly pale, stood to be heard. With marked earnestness, he marshaled all past arguments and reasoning against premature separation from Britain. He had prepared himself, apparently, with great labor and ardent zeal, Adams would recall admiringly. He conducted the debate not only with great ingenuity and eloquence, but with equal politeness and candor. Though no one transcribed the speech, Dickinson's extensive notes would survive. He knew how unpopular he had become, Dickinson began. He knew that by standing firm as a matter of principle, he was almost certainly ending his career. "My conduct this day, I expect, will give the finishing blow to my once great and now too diminished popularity. But thinking as I do on the subject of debate, silence would be guilt." To proceed now with a declaration of independence, he said, would be to brave the storm in a skiff made of paper. When he sat down, all was silent, except for the rain that had begun spattering against the windows. No one spoke, no one rose to answer him, until Adams, at last, determined to speak. "He wished now, as never in his life," Adams began, "that he had the gifts of the ancient orators of Greece and Rome. For he was certain none of them ever had before him a question of greater importance." Outside, the wind picked up. The storm struck with thunder, lightning, and pelting rain. In his schoolmaster days at Worcester, Adams had recorded how such storms unstrung him. Now he spoke on steadily, making the case for independence as he had so often before. He was logical, positive, sensitive to the historic importance of the moment, and, looking into the future, saw a new nation, a new time, all much in the spirit of lines he had written in a recent letter to a friend. "Objects of the most stupendous magnitude, measures in which the lives and liberties of millions, born and unborn, are most essentially interested, are now before us. We are in the very midst of revolution, the most complete, unexpected, and remarkable of any in the history of the world." No transcription was made, no notes were kept. There would be only Adams's own recollections, plus those of several others who would remember more the force of Adams himself than any particular thing he said. That it was the most powerful and important speech heard in the Congress since it first convened, and the greatest speech of Adams's life, there is no question. To Jefferson, Adams was not graceful, nor elegant, nor remarkably fluent, but spoke with a power of thought and expression that moved us from our seats. Recalling the moment long afterward, Adams would say he had been carried out of himself. Carried out in spirit, as enthusiastic preachers sometimes express themselves. To Richard Stockton, one of the new delegates from New Jersey, Adams was the Atlas of the hour. "The man to whom the country is most indebted for the great measure of independency. He it was who sustained the debate, and by the force of his reasoning, demonstrated not only the justice, but the expediency of the measure." Stockton and two other new delegates from New Jersey, Francis Hopkinson and the Reverend John Witherspoon, famous Presbyterian preacher and president of the College of New Jersey at Princeton, had come into the chamber an hour or so after Adams had taken the floor and was nearly finished speaking. When they asked that Adams repeat what they had missed, he objected. He was not an actor there to entertain an audience, he said good-naturedly, but at the urging of Edward Rutledge, who told Adams that only he had the facts at his command, Adams relinquished and gave the speech a second time, in as concise a manner as I could, till at length the New Jersey gentlemen said they were fully satisfied and ready for the question. By then he had been on his feet for 2 hours. Others spoke, including Witherspoon, the first clergyman to serve in Congress, whose manner of speech made plain his Scottish origins. In all, the debate lasted 9 hours. At one point, according to Adams, Hughes of North Carolina, who had long opposed separation from Britain, started suddenly upright and, lifting up both his hands to heaven as if he had been in a trance, cried out, "It is done, and I will abide by it." But when later that evening a preliminary vote was taken, 4 colonies unexpectedly held back, refusing to proclaim independence. The all-important Pennsylvania delegation, despite popular opinion in Pennsylvania, stood with John Dickinson and voted no. The New York delegates abstained, saying they favored the motion but lacked specific instructions. South Carolina, too, surprisingly, voted no, while Delaware, with only 2 delegates present, was divided. The missing Delaware delegate was Caesar Rodney, one of the most ardent of the independence faction. Where he was or when he might reappear was unclear, but a rider had been sent racing off to find him. When Edward Rutledge rescued the moment by moving that a final vote be postponed until the next day, implying that for the sake of unanimity South Carolina might change its mind, Adams and the others immediately agreed. For while the 9 colonies supporting independence made a clear majority, it was hardly the show of solidarity that such a step ought to have. The atmosphere that night at City Tavern and in the lodging houses of the delegates was extremely tense. The crux of the matter was the Pennsylvania delegation. For in the preliminary vote, 3 of the 7 Pennsylvania delegates had gone against John Dickinson and declared in the affirmative. And it was of utmost interest that 1 of the 3, along with Franklin and John Morton, was James Wilson, who, though a friend and ally of Dickinson, had switched sides to vote for independence. The question now was how many of the rest who were in league with Dickinson would, on the morrow, continue, in Adams's words, to vote point-blank against the known and declared sense of their constituents. To compound the tension that night, word reached Philadelphia of the sighting off New York of 100 British ships, the first arrivals of a fleet that would number over 400. Though the record of all that happened the following day, Tuesday, July 2nd, is regrettably sparse, it appears that just as the doors to Congress were about to be closed at the usual hour of 9 o'clock, Caesar Rodney, mud-spattered, booted and spurred, made his dramatic entrance. The tall, thin Rodney, the oddest-looking man in the world, Adams once described him, had been made to appear stranger still, and more to be pitied, by a skin cancer on one side of his face that he kept hidden behind a scarf of green silk. But, as Adams had also recognized, Rodney was a man of spirit, of fire. Almost unimaginably, he had ridden 80 miles through the night, changing horses several times, to be there in time to cast his vote. Yet, more important even than the arrival of Rodney, were 2 empty chairs among the Pennsylvania delegation. Refusing to vote for independence, but understanding the need for Congress to speak with one voice, John Dickinson and Robert Morris had voluntarily absented themselves from the proceedings, thus swinging Pennsylvania behind independence by a vote of 3-2. What private agreements had been made the night before, if any, who or how many had come to the State House that morning knowing what was afoot, no one recorded. Outside, more rain threatened. And at about 10 came another cloudburst, like the day before. New York continued to abstain, but South Carolina, as hinted by Edward Rutledge, joined the majority to make the decision unanimous in the sense that no colony stood opposed. The vote went rapidly. So, it was done. The break was made. In words, at least. On July 2nd, 1776, in Philadelphia, the American colonies declared independence. If not all 13 clocks had struck as one, 12 had. And with the other silent, the effect was the same. It was John Adams more than anyone who had made it happen. Further, he seems to have understood more clearly than any what a momentous day it was, and in the privacy of two long letters to Abigail, he poured out his feelings as did no one else. The second day of July 1776 will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward forevermore. Lest she judge him overly transported, he said he was well aware of the